Show Me the Way, episode 18, a two-timer of a plumbing M&A. In this episode, we talk with Steve Burbridge about his life experiences as an owner of a plumbing company and his dealing with growing the company, the sale of his business, and his experiences in selling the businesses. Welcome to Show Me the Way, a podcast presented by Spencer Fain, LLP, about business succession planning, the merger and acquisition experience, and successful exits. I'm your host, Dave Sider. Joining me on today's show is Steve Burbridge. Steve's going to share his secrets in his role as a member of the C-suite in two different companies, how he went about growing the businesses, and how he went about selling the business. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave.
So, Steve, a little bit. I always like to give people a little bit of the background about who you are and where you grew up as a way to give people a little bit better feel about yourself. Are you born and raised Kansas Cityan?
Yeah, I'm a local product all the way through. I grew up in Prairie Village, Kansas, went to Shawnee Mission East High School. Then I ventured way down the road to University of Kansas. So I've been around here my whole life and ended up getting an accounting degree and with business administration.
So for some of our listeners on the coast, Prairie Village is a subsidiary of Kansas City. Right. As a lot of people have listened in on this show, Kansas City sits on the state line. So we always ask folks, are you from the Missouri side or the Kansas side? In fact, we have a very significant road here in Kansas City called State Line. And if you're going north on State Line, you're in Missouri. And if you're going south, you're in Kansas. So I'll give you a little context about that. So you left the University of Kansas. How did you get into the plumbing business?
That's a good question because it doesn't typically go with accounting, right? So when I graduated, which was many years ago, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And by the advice of a wealthy person that was an alumni of the fraternity I was in, I gave him my options that I had, several job offers and things. And I threw in, my dad had a union plumbing company, and I threw that in at the very end, just as, you know, as like a default. And he jumped all over that and he said, "That's what you ought to do." Huh. And I said, "Well, I'm really not thinking about that very seriously." And he said, I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because you can control your own destiny." And that rang with me pretty well. And he had been successful in a short period of time taking over his grandfather's company. So I thought about that and I thought about all the options. And then I went to my dad and, you know, he said, "Well, there's got to be a bathroom in every building." And I said, "Well, that's true. There's job security there." And he said, "There's only one issue you're going to have." He says, "You absolutely have to know the business," because he ended up owning a plumbing business, but he was not a plumber. And he said, you can't go through what I did. You know, he says, "You have to be an expert at that trade as well." So I had a lot of nervous energy at that time anyway, just a very active person. So I went to plumbing school for four more years after KU.
Wow.
And then I got my master plumber's license and master mechanical license and various different licenses. So I learned the trade. I worked out in commercial construction for 2 years as a plumber. And then I switched over 2 years and worked in the HVAC industry for 2 years. So I did get, you know, an extensive amount of field experience, but certainly it was all very memorable and a great education for me, of a lot different than what my college education was about.
Well, I was going to say, now that you've had both experiences, what do you say to people that say that, you know, the only way forward is with a college education?
Yeah. Well, that's obviously not true at all. I didn't really use for many years. I mean, some of the things I did use, but I just think education in general is the key. It doesn't matter if it's, you know, a college education or not. I think if you have the perspective that you're a lifetime student and you spend every day in studying something, learning something, using your time well, that education is absolutely critical.
Absolutely. The other fascinating thing with that statement, my mother said, if you want to control your own destiny, go to professional school. Based upon results, I think you've done extremely well, Mr. Burbridge.
Well, thank you. That was good advice, and glad I did that.
So I get it now. You've been out in the field. So obviously you got the technical skills of being a plumber and HVAC, and you're also an accountant by training at the university. What was the next step? You completed all of that.
I learned the field. I learned the plumbing industry. My dad had purchased he had a union plumbing company, and I went through a union plumbing school, and it was an excellent school. It's 4 years. It's a long time. Probably could have been condensed down, but I worked with some very, very sharp people and very skilled, mechanically inclined, and learned a lot. My dad had bought a non-union HVAC company that had only two people and one truck, very, very small. And basically, he didn't give it to me, but he allowed me to go operate that company. And I grew that company every year. I believe in double-digit profit and double-digit growth every year. And so I just grew that company by hard work and not really knowing what to do, but a lot of long hours and hard work to the point. So in 1993, I bought the company from my dad. And then, we were growing very well. And then 3 years later, as part of a best practices group that I was in, we did a 351 stock transfer, and 11 of us joined together to form a first publicly traded HVAC company, which was very exciting.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So then I was really, that was very exciting because now I'm using my KU degree. And I really was, the more we grew the company and became way more involved financially. He helped me certainly, he was an accountant. So he helped me on that end of it until I kind of took it over and I was more operational. And then when he retired in 1993, I knew both operations and the business side of it. So, and then 3 years later, took the company public. That was very exciting. We were a consolidator. And so it was a quarterly treadmill of making the number, which was really fun. It was actually fun. Budgeting and forecasting became way more serious than it ever had been before. Yeah. But we all had stock in it, and I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot. I was working around some really sharp people, and I feel very blessed to have that experience. And so it went really well. Our stock went from 13 to 38, and in 3 years.
Wow!
So that as long as the game is, you got to make sure every quarter you're making the anticipated number. And we were really doing that by bringing in, by acquiring companies every quarter, as well as internally. We did pretty well, but you can grow, of course, a lot faster with acquisition. And anyway, that was fun. Then our parent company, we weren't based in Kansas City. We were based in Nashville. And then it was fun. We were bought by a major manufacturer. It was fun up until that point. When we bought by a major manufacturer, the manufacturer really was going out on a limb to buy a service business, and it wasn't so fun anymore. Still good life lessons there, but it wasn't successful. It wasn't fun anymore. It actually hurt the manufacturer. And I stayed on because really what I saw was they did disassemble what they had acquired and aggregated, and they started selling off businesses, and I thought, boy, this is going to be great. I will be getting a chance to buy back, for pennies on the dollar, hopefully, what my old company. And I always treated it like it was still my company anyway. I mean, I had ownership in a much bigger company, but I still, in an essence, still had ownership in the company. So that was interesting. I left there at the end of 2005, and I set out 1 year in a non-compete, and then I bought my current company in 2007 from the founder's oldest son who had owned it. And I knew then I would never, be in that public arena again. I didn't know exactly what my Sarbanes-Oxley was passed during that time frame also.
Right.
And being part of a public company wasn't as much fun anymore. And, I was really blessed to be able to get a second chance and do it all over again and still make mistakes, but I don't think I made near as many or the same mistakes I had made earlier. and technology was accelerating so greatly, we were able to really grow through that, through using technology that maybe other companies weren't using. And we just stayed ahead of the competition and grew very, very rapidly. It was also a very small business. In 2007, when I bought it, there was only four people besides the husband and wife owners. So it was very, very small. When you're only four people, it was those first years were a lot of hard work growing a small business. I chose to do that though, instead of just starting a brand new business from the beginning. I think there was, the phone was ringing. It just didn't ring very much. But there was a phone line. There was an established business that was actually founded in 1951. So there was good things there. And I'd say it's easier than starting from scratch.
I mean, that's an interesting analysis, because the wisdom I think that I've seen with people is it's better to buy than to start. Because you can just hit the ground running. I mean, what is your,
The phones, in this case, which is true with a lot of businesses, but I mean, I took marketing courses in school, certainly, and I remember mm-hmm. them very well. And my dad actually taught me a lot of things in marketing, and I continued to go to school on marketing, and I'm still involved with that. So I was just able to take an established company that did very little marketing at all. And, the owner was a civil engineer, great guy, but he just was not marketing. There wasn't a marketing bone in his body, I don't think. He just expected the phone to ring and wait there for it. And you can't do that if you're really going to, have your foot on the gas. So I just started marketing the company and then implementing technology and implementing things to grow the business. And it just took off, and it's, still taking off. I mean, it's just been a great ride with huge growth every year. So we're still continuing that growth even now that we're getting to be much larger. It's easy to grow, it's easy to double a dollar. It's a lot harder to double, 30 million and 40 million and 50 mm-hmm. million. And so the first years, there's always a lot of growth. It is a lot of hard work. And then comes the real planning and strategic planning and investments to continue that kind of, 20 and 30% growth a year.
Well, that's why I call you a two-timer, because you've had two different businesses.
Right. I am a two-timer.
What do you know about the business now that you wish you would have known with your first business? Because this is unique, Steve. Not a lot of people do this, This is what you've gone through is unusual and very unique.
One of my faults was I was working too much in the business. Mm-hmm. Because I started in the business, I started out in the field. I knew how to fix things. I knew how to install mm-hmm. things. I knew the trade, which is good, and it can be bad. You need to know the trade, or you need to know, what the business does, certainly. And then I should have done a faster and better job of pulling myself out of that and working on the business more and delegating better and relying on others to do more working in the business stuff. So I was doing both. I was burning the candle, in essence, at both ends, working 12-hour days, running training meetings, plus running the business. And, I'm not a person to shy away from work. So I put the hours in to grow it. But I looking back, I wish I would have been focusing more just on running the business and maybe not being so involved in working in the business.
But isn't that how you learn? I mean, I know there's a book called The E-Myth, and they've got it for about every trade.
Right.
And I think, frankly, that guy was an attorney. I think he started with lawyers, and lawyers have never learned that.
Michael Gerber, yes. Yep.
Yeah, very good.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And that is a good book. And there's tons of good books out there, but that was me. I had an entrepreneurial seizure, and then, but I did have the business background to where I finally figured out I got to get out of the business. So, and I had to start mm-hmm. saying no. And people, they couldn't keep coming to me for answers. I learned one time, a guy came up with, he had some service invoices and stuff in his hand, and I kept my hands in my pocket. I knew if I grabbed that invoice, I was sucked in. Mm-hmm. So I just mm-hmm. listened to him. And I finally got better at not taking on more stuff. My plate was already very full. And I just listened to him, of course. And then I talked him through it and made him come up with his own solution, or helped him come up with his own solution instead of me. Because I could have said, here, let me handle that, you know.
I can
get that done in 2 minutes, or I can fix that in five. You know, I had to stop doing that. So that was my own thing of, I wish I would have been more on the business. And by doing that, I mean, you know, we had 3 and 5 year plans, and, you know, we were growing so fast that 5 year plans seemed to be kind of hard to predict. And then 3 year plan, you know, really kind of come, if you're really growing fast, you end up going, this is what I started doing is a trailing 12 month budget, because it's hard. You know, you budget in November and December on a fiscal calendar year, but your business is totally changed by July. I mean, right. 6-7 months later.
Right.
And then that budget just seems, well, you know, those numbers seem so small. Why, how did we even, you know? So I like the trailing 12 month, and I like, you know, when you, I have a gas pedal in my office from it that I took out of it. if you have your foot on the gas, then business is really fun and exciting. And when you're growing like that, it's hard to I should have been better at thinking bigger numbers, projecting out. So
I can't tell you how many people, though. I mean, over the years, the clients I've represented, but the people I also have talked to through the podcast, every one of them said, I wish I would have gotten out of working in the business to working on the business. I can't tell you anyone that didn't express it, but I think it's something everybody has to go through. So at the same time, not everyone graduates from that, but here you are, you have multiple degrees, and, you know, having worked with construction companies forever, I look at a master license no different than I look at a ticket from a college. In fact, I probably look at that as a higher price, because you can actually do something with the master license than you can with a college certificate. I don't mean to demean college, because it's a great place to go learn certain things, but you've got now multiple degrees, frankly, of higher education beyond the basics. You've run two companies, and you're still affiliated with your current company, but you sold out of that. What led you to that conclusion? Let's go back to the first one. It sounds like the first company you left because it was just time, the company was not going the right way. But this time with the second company, you probably went through a different analysis or looked at it because you weren't really compelled to leave, or at least the business was still going down the right road.
Right. Yeah. The best time to sell is when you're not compelled, right? Definition of like fair market value too, a non-compelled seller. And the other thing is on the valuations, if you're growing, and they usually will value based on trailing 12 months, there's no hurry, you know, because the value's going up. That number is going up. Adjusted EBITDA is going up. So, and if the market's doing well, multiples might be going up as well. So you don't want to be in a hurry, I think, if you're going to make a transition and sell. So allow yourself plenty of time on it. But it just seemed like, you know, the timing of selling is tough. It was very tough for me. I'd certainly prayed about it. I had peace with it. I allowed 4 minority shareholders. I had 4 people that I worked with. Some of those, 3 of those 4 I'd worked with for over 25 years, I think, each. They were with me at my first company. And I felt like I had a fiduciary responsibility to them to at least, and then see what the valuations were for the company. One of the 4 was wanting to retire, and I was in a best practices group with HVAC and plumbing electric contractors around the country. And that was awesome, because we were roughly the same size, or actually most of them were bigger than us, that I was at the company I had, but they allowed me to be in the group. And those companies were awesome. And learning from, you know, people all around the U.S. and much bigger markets than Kansas City, it was very good for me, and just a good friendship relationship. And then these guys started joining private equity and becoming platform companies. And so it opened my eyes that, boy, you know, this home services market it's a desired market for private equity to be in. When COVID hit, it was certainly an essential service business, and we didn't, with people working from their homes more now, our business didn't go down any. It went, you know, it just accelerated, just through gas on the fire that was already there. So it was very exciting. And anyway, just one of the guys in my best practices group, he had joined a private equity, you know, platform company, and he said, you know, why don't you talk to the people at this fund that we're with now? And I said, well, you know, okay. And again, thinking I have a fiduciary responsibility to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not thinking of myself, but thinking of these four minority shareholders. Anyway, I did. And I spent about 4 months dealing with them. And that's 4 months I'll never get back. And I showed them respect, and
right,
because of my friend being with them. And then if he only knew some of the stuff they pulled, you know, but I realized after that experience, there was a lot of high pressure there. You know, you got to sign this, mm-hmm. this offer is only mm-hmm. good till this Thursday at 9:00 PM. And it wasn't, you know, I could see that the culture was not going to go well with what I'm, how I'm wired. So mm-hmm. that deal, I finally, after a lot of aggravation, instead of saying, you know, no, I think I said, heck no, mm-hmm. you know, that it just wasn't going to be a good fit. And I, you know, I was dealing mostly with a junior private equity person who was pretty darn, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that. The guy's, I'm sure, very smart, but he 28 years old and treated me, I'm a little bit older than that, but the pressure, like I said, telling me what I needed to do by a certain time and all this, and, or the offer was going to go away and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And it was, you know, attempting to intimidate me. And it, of course, it just ticked me off. And I can't tell you how many, they must have given me, I don't know, 4 or 5 LOIs during that time frame that I wouldn't sign. And, you know, and of course, everyone was getting higher and higher, which was good, but it still wasn't. And I did have a number in my mind, by the way. You know, I wanted to hit a certain number, and I won't go into the details, but I just had that number in mind, and I knew we would be there someday. And if it wasn't, you know, if the timing wasn't right, it's just not right. Well, you know, I was, again, not compelled to sell. So I just, from that experience, I knew that I mean, I worked on that for 4 months, 7 days a week, and even on vacation. There was a Saturday and Sundays were actually bigger work days than during the week because I was still working in the business. And it wore me out. It wasn't a great experience. And I knew I needed somebody to be an intermediary and to, you know, advocate for me. So I had that experience, but it was good. I did learn from it. I just learned that I wasn't going to do it on myself again. I wasn't going to go through that again.
Mm. Well, it sounds like, too, you use the word, and I hear this a lot, culture. And with some people, when I hear the culture word, I'm thinking they're saying, you know, my business does not get along with their business. Whatever that looks like is culture. They're just wired differently. You know, if this is going to be a publicly traded company and I'm not a publicly traded company, does that work or does it not work? If they're very driven on purely numbers, and aren't we all at some level, but if there is no other outlet versus, you know, maybe it is about the client or the customer, you know, is that consistent or not? Are those some of the things that were going through your mind? Because it's interesting when I ask that question, I get different responses.
Yeah, it definitely is. And again, this was my first time. I was a rookie at, even though I had done this prior with a group of other guys and you know, mm-hmm. many years earlier, but it was a different thing back in the 90s than this is, you know, this going public was different than going with private equity. And, you know, my exposure to this firm and my dealings with this firm, this wasn't a real positive thing. And I didn't know any different. Again, first time, I just learned from it to know that this wasn't a good fit. And, you know, I went a different direction, and I had already met, there is in our industry, there's a few firms that specialize in brokering home service businesses. And I'd already met one of those guys, and he had talked to our best practices group, and one of the guys in our group had already used this guy. So I knew, you know, I had a resource there And after I went through this experience, I contacted him and, you know, that changed everything.
Well, it also seems to be, again, you are working in the business relative to selling the business versus working on the business. Again, another analogy, if hopefully I'm being fair.
Yeah, that's right. Well, selling the business becomes a full-time job, and then, you know, then something's going to sacrifice. Right. Selling the business is a full-time job. Yeah, absolutely. There's no way, if you do it right and you have this company of any size, it's going to be your life for, you know, for me, after I hired, call it an investment banker, but the person I hired was Fred from SF&P Advisors. And, you know, he's a real professional. And that changed everything. And so from that point, when I hired him to the deal being done, took 9 months. So that's still, even with that, you know, that kind of person, it takes that long. And we had a little bit of that was dragged out with COVID hitting. But if you remember, Dave. So it hit right during that time frame, which caused some angst among attorneys and on the legal sides. But it was good after that.
Yes.
But before that, trying to do it on myself, it just wasn't good.
But you hit on another key issue. The first one I heard is timing, timing, timing. That's the first thing I heard. And the second thing that I heard here is, you know, it is a process. And through the process, there are a lot of ups and downs, I take it. Things that go on, and you really need help. And I've seen this quite a few times. People will try to run their business and sell the business. And I think they're worn out. They're exhausted mentally, physically, spiritually. And it's just a very, very difficult role to hoe. And like you, I recommend bringing in people, you know, just to help, because it's just, there's just not enough hours in the friggin' day.
Right. And most business owners don't, you know, they only do this typically once or twice in their lifetime, and they don't have the experience. They don't have the information they need. So when you get into these deals, I mean, there's negotiating with it, and to have an edge, or to, you know, you never want to go into negotiation not being informed. And I think, you know, you got to have as much information as you can get. So you need to put together a team of people to do the deal, because the business owner he or she is going to, you know, only be an expert at that business and not at the business of selling and the business of all the regulations and everything else you go through, and valuations and tax strategies and all that other stuff. So, you know, our the paper copies of the documents used in our deal is 4 inches thick.
Right.
4 inches. And, you know, I didn't realize it was going to be that thick because we were doing it all digitally. But when a copy did get printed, I looked at that and it's amazing. It's 4 inches thick.
Well, and I think one of the things you hit on through the process that you found with the first group you didn't go with is finding the right buyer. What did the right buyer look like to you, you know, now that you can reflect back?
Yeah, that's a good question. We had as many people looked at us, wanted to partner with us, and we had a lot of choices there. And it's a weird deal doing it, because it's like speed dating or something. I mean, they don't really know you for very long. Now, in our case, they do respect you more as a seller if you do have a good broker or a good investment banker. And in my case, you know, Fred put together a deck on our business, which was, you know, all the pertinent information, the packaging of it, and making it look, what, you know, printing us up, I guess, and then for the speed dating. And so the private equity, they almost all knew him. I think they all did know him and respected him and knew that if he's presenting it, that the numbers are probably going to be good to rely on. And the things that they would normally ask was packaged up. Of course, they go way in depth and can think of a lot of questions. But so in that, you know, you just get a feel for, you know, do you want to be a platform company? Is this going to be a good fit? For me, one of the things, if they talked about coworkers and customers quite a bit, that was a good sign. If they didn't, then I knew they didn't probably care too much about my coworkers and my customers. Right. And I say my, but I mean, that's what a business consists of. So that was a tip. I mean, I just kind of, I would listen real intently. I took a ton of notes and, you know, I would ask him the, you know, the R factor question, but I would ask him right. And one of the things that always struck me when I would ask that question is if, you know, if we were sitting here 1 year from today, what has to happen for this to be considered a success? Right. And many of the responses were, well, you would retain your coworkers, that you wouldn't lose any. And I thought, interesting. You know, I certainly wasn't planning on losing any. And I was hoping this all would be good. But it kind of told me that they must have some businesses that just deteriorate pretty quickly after they acquire. And I didn't want to be with any of those kind of companies, of course. And, I also did not want to have to teach somebody our industry. And some of the private equities, many of them.
Yes. You have no idea. You
know, many of them. They go towards where the action is, where the valuations are, where they've seen deals done and they've been very successful acquiring and selling, consolidating and selling at a bigger multiple and certainly bigger EBITDA. And so there's a lot that want to get into the industry, but there's not that many that are really in the industry. And right. For me, I just didn't want to spend the time to teach somebody and answer a lot of questions. I didn't want to be that kind of person to have to spend the amount of time it takes to teach smart business people our particular industry. And I'd rather deal with somebody that kind of has a feel for our industry already. And that did influence my decision. It's a very hard thing to do though. I mean, they'll come in, they'll eat lunch with you. They'll spend an afternoon with you and, you know, 4 to 8 hours later, they're done and they can actually generate a proposal. And I'm amazed how quickly that process goes. For me, I wouldn't sign anything or do anything until I went and saw their place. I wanted to go, they could see our place, but I wanted to see what they were all about. So I chartered a plane and flew and, you know, one day to go see their headquarters, meet their people, flew back and that was very helpful. I also talked to a lot of the former owners of businesses they had acquired, and many of those were not in our industry, but some were in our industry, and tried to, you know, to get a feel for what to expect. And you have to be careful dealing. I mean, you want to ask the right questions when you talk to the former owners, but one of those questions is, do you still have stock in the company? Because if they do, yeah. Because if they do, you know what? Some of their comments might be a little bit more rosy than
right.
reality, because they still have a stake in it. So I would ask that question, and what I basically found from doing that kind of investigation is what we know is, you know, yes, they make mistakes. Like the company I went with, they make mistakes, but they normally correct them pretty quickly, and they are pulling the same direction. It's not fragmented. It's not, you know, what it's for the interest of everybody instead of a few individuals being enriched. And that's a good feeling to be involved with. The culture just has to be that way. I mean, you want people to be friendly and yet, you know, professional. And we have a different culture in the Midwest, maybe than the East and West Coast areas. And
you mean we have the right culture.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just saying. So,
but I'm a Midwest person, and so it's a little bit different than maybe dealing with. I don't have the accents that some of the others do, but there's a lot of good private equity out there, especially you know, when you get to the senior level people at private equity, they are very sharp people. I think everyone I met was very sharp, and they almost were like college professors, and you know, you could talk any business with them, and I thoroughly enjoyed that part of it. So you just, it's a timing thing. It's a feel. You just have to be at peace with it. I don't know if there's ever a great time to sell, but in your own gut, you have to just get that good feeling. Okay. This is good. And of course, if you've got you want to have a number in mind and have a logical way of getting to that number. And if they can get to your number, then, you know, then you usually were going to. Yeah, it's time to go. That's right. Get on the bus.
You know, this is for our listeners. This is a masterclass. Steve has gone into, and I really appreciate you doing this, Steve, a lot of real world detail, both, you know, very, frankly, very analytical, but very experiential at the same time. These are lessons that you've learned. Really appreciate you sharing it. And it leads me to ask a couple more questions. Each deal I've seen, well, I appreciate what you're saying about employees and customers. It's a people business. If you don't hear people in there, you know, then I think if somebody's getting bought out, they're taking the money and running. That's okay. It's their business. But right. I've seen it with some companies that leaves a lot of people that you brought along in the lurch. But also so again, I take that away or reinforce that notion. But also, you want to sell to somebody that understands to some degree your business, that it's not their first mm-hmm. rodeo, as we say here in Kansas.
Right, right. That's right.
At the same time, issues come along, such as, if I may bring this up, deal fatigue. In every deal, yeah. there's deal fatigue where you're worn out. Do you remember yeah. your deal fatigue times?
Yeah.
And how did you deal with it? Because that's kind of the thing. Until you're there, you don't know anything about it. But everybody's going to go through it, right? Whether they like it or not.
Oh yes. Well, and in my particular case, you know, COVID had just hit. Right. So it complicated things. It wasn't like I could just run over to your office or places and, you know, Zoom meetings and scanning documents became a very important thing.
Right.
You know, the usage of paper printing went way down. And so you do get deal fatigue. Although I would say dealing with professionals, a professional accounting firm, a professional law firm, and I'd say that, and then also, of course, an investment banker, if you get the right people, you're going to still have fatigue, but it's not going to be as bad as if you're trying to do it yourself, or if you're dealing with the wrong people on your team, and then it can be aggravating. And I will say I was one of those people. You probably remember, I was probably one of your pain in the tail clients, but I do read the documents. And yes. I couldn't really, you know, it'd be a 45 page document, or I'm going to read 45 pages, even if the last mm-hmm. five is all boilerplate. I still wanted to read it. So I felt like I needed to understand it. And again, in my case, I had four minority shareholders that I had to explain this to. And if they asked me a question and I didn't know it, I was going to look pretty dumb. I didn't want to look dumb. And I read every document and I wanted to understand every document. And one of the things in that I figured out part of the way through is that, Dave, you are a quarterback. You know, you're the guy. Because you were using attorneys from all around the country on my behalf and from your firm. I didn't realize you had that many offices all around the country, because situations came up during my deal that required expertise that would not normally be needed, you know, but it just came up. So right. you have these resources right. of, I don't know if we use 10 different attorneys for their own very specialized areas, and you know, you kind of kept the thing going. You were dealing with the private equities law firm, which was which also was a major law firm. And, you know, that I think helps keep the fatigue down. It's probably going to happen. I had one friend of mine sold his company, and he was the kind of guy that didn't read through really the documents very mm-hmm. much. And he was a very small generalist type law firm attorney, basically one attorney. And, you know, the things you came up with or your team came up with was totally different than what this generalist attorney came up with. I mean, I'm not so sure the generalist even read over the documents. I mean, they just signed everything that was presented to them. And, you know, I don't know if that was really in the client's best interest there. Whereas we negotiated for a long period of time and with the other side, and I say the other side, which is another weird thing about it, because they're going to be your partner. So that's another reason to have people negotiating for you, because you can't take the posture you'd like to take if it was yourself doing it, because you're going to turn around and be a partner with that firm. So that puts you in a sticky situation. And there are things that come up. If you're involved in a deal there, as you well know, there are going to be disagreements. Absolutely. There's going to have to be common ground found, and there's going to be a reasonableness about this wording. And in our case, it was COVID, and was new language was being drafted about that.
Right.
It was all It was all new for all of us, and including the legal profession. And so it probably took longer, but the deal got done even through the very beginnings of COVID. We were able to get the deal through. Little delay to it, but that was not on our behalf. It was just appropriate to delay it basically at the time because there were so many unknowns. But anyway, you do get fatigued just because the length of time it takes, and there's just so many things that you don't necessarily think about that are going to be involved with it. And there's a lot of details that go into it.
You know, one of the things I didn't share with you at the time that I could share with you now is running a different deal, much smaller deal at the same time. It did not make it out of COVID because the private equity group got scared.
Yeah.
And they just backed away altogether.
Right.
And you're right. Every year it's something, you know, COVID, the first year, the second year and working on deals, there's issue with supply chains. Third year, it's inflationary trends and interest rates. So every year in an M&A, there's an issue. I mean, it just is what it is. And so my theory has been, you know, I do enough M&As, but go find the subject matter expert in the particular area instead of trying to get your generalist to get up to battle speed. You know, go out and get that, you know, employee benefits person who deals strictly with ESOPs, only 100% S-Corp ESOP, have them come in, plug them in, get it done, move on down the road. Because at the end of the day, you want to keep the process going. You don't want the attorney, you don't want the professional, you don't want the investment banker slowing it down, because the train can go off the track. And if there's a chance it's going to go off the track, it increases the deal fatigue and potentially the frustration hits all the parties, and they may say it's not worth it anymore. And we have to remember, if you signed an LOI, but probably a pretty good reason why the business ought to be sold. So don't try to screw it up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. And some people, I'll just bring this up because, you know, I deal with people, contractors, in the home service business every day. And they think about, oh my gosh, you know, the cost of dealing with, you know, professional accounting firms, professional law firms and investment bankers. And there's a cost to it. And I can tell you my firm, we are not the lowest cost provider in the market. And we do know our cost, whereas I have competitors that don't even know their costs. That's how crazy the service business is. And when you deal with mom and pops, but we do have accurate accounting. But anyway, I don't let somebody's fees derail me from, oh my gosh, you know, they cost this, or this investment banker, he gets a percentage of the deal. Well, I think you if you want to deal with professional people, there's an expense to it, and it's the best expense you can possibly do, because your top line number is going to be so much bigger. And you're going to, you know, all the things that go into it, I'm very willing to pay the money, knowing that I'm getting the best deal, and my dollar amount's going to be the best at the top. So they actually, in many ways, don't necessarily cost, they pay, because you're going to get a better deal and the terms you need and want and the number you want. So, you know, I can't emphasize that enough, is to get the good people on your team, and people that have done this before, that do it all day long, not just done it once or twice, or they had a client that did it and, you know, their friend down the street represented them or whatever. I'm talking about people that all day long, this is all they do, is M&A deals. That's who you want on your team. And they've got the experience to do it. Now, one thing you mentioned about the LOI, I was going to say is, and I didn't probably even tell you this, but an LOI is a non-binding legal document, correct?
Correct.
The one binding part is you're taken off the market. You can't negotiate with anybody else. Is that correct? Okay. So in the back of my mind, there was some language in my LOI that I didn't really agree with, you know, but I thought, now there's going to be a contract coming, and you know, it's non-binding anyway. You know, don't worry about it. You know, it's not worth fooling around. Well, later, I'm just pointing this out. Later, when it's time to go to contract, you know, I thought, well, we'll get it fixed then, and we'll get the wording right then. And then, of course, private equity says, well, wait a minute, you signed that LOI and it says, yeah. And I said, non-binding. And they said, yeah, but you signed it. And so learn from that is if there is something in the LOI that gives you heartburn, go ahead and get it addressed there and maybe start to go, you know, see how they negotiate at that point before you even get to the contract stage. Because they attempted to hold that against me when I said, whoa, it's non-binding. Yeah, but you signed it.
Thank you so much. No, because somebody not all that long ago said the same thing to me. And I said, here's what's happened. It's non-binding. But at the same time, they're testing, you know, your good faith. They're testing, frankly, your ethics, right?
Okay.
You know, I mean, because they come back and say that, you know, this old adage, you're not a man of your word. But when somebody does something like that, I can go back and say, well, here are the 25 other things that have changed since we the LOI. So I don't know. Where do you want to parse it? You
know, that's funny. Something. Yeah. So that's good. I didn't look at it that way. I just looked at it as, hey, we can negotiate that later, you know, or we'll get the wording right later. Yeah.
So I take away timing. Very important. Yep. Culture is very important within culture. How often are they talking about employees? How often are they talking about customers as part of the, you know, culture conversation? I'm also hearing, you know, have they done this before in this industry? Two things. Have they done this before? I've had one of those situations where, to your point, a couple of young guys came in and bought one of my clients. It was brand new, and we were kind of helping them through the process. So you'd like to know that they've done it before so they know the good and the bad and the indifferent, but also they understand the industry. And then bring people around you to help you get it done because there is deal fatigue. You can't do it all yourself. You're just going to wear yourself out. And hopefully professionals will either help you make money or at least minimize, in all instances, the downside so that you can, you know, frankly, right away, you know, into the sunset feeling pretty good about it and not being drugged back in on it, you know, later down the road.
Yeah, and certainly I you know, all these deals have a tax situation with them. It becomes actually a pretty important big part of how the deal's structured. And that's something that I was just if you remember my deal, but it was a membership interest purchase agreement and a MIPA. And you know, it was all legal, of course, but man, the amount of work that goes in to minimize taxes was really fun to see. I mean, that was you guys between the attorneys and the accountants, they dueled it out. I enjoyed every minute of it and listened to those conference calls and things. And it's fun to watch you or listen and watch you guys work on that.
Well, to your point, I always say in these kind of deals, there's cash flow and tax and law somewhere down the road. I'm not sure exactly where, but you got to really, you know, knock those out and, you know, do what we call waterfalls. I mean, there's money in their taxes. Now, how much do I put in my pocket? Because until you get there, is it really worthwhile? You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, I think this has been one of the master classes here. I really appreciate your willingness to discuss your situation. It's such intimate detail. You probably did a better class on M&As than most attorneys that I've hung around to what the real world is. If there are two or three points you probably want to leave people with, what would that be in your mind?
Well, I mean, I just kind of recap then really is I would say get a team of professional people together, use a broker / investment banker, use a law firm that is an M&A firm or really has a big M&A component to it with the right attorneys involved, because there's going to be a lot of specialties there putting a deal together. And of course, a very good accounting firm as well. Not just an accountant, but an accounting firm that has the staff that can do the time and the expertise on structuring the deal, helping with the deal. And then I'd say, you know, don't, and I said this before, but don't be in a hurry. And know that this, like you said before, this is a process. It's something you work in. I mean, accumulate this, grow this business. It's going to take time. If you're not in a hurry, maybe it would help avoid the deal fatigue because it does take a lot of time. There is a lot of details. There's a lot of people involved.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember right on our which is kind of a fun call to be on, is the day that the funds transfer. You remember that? Were you on that call?
Oh, yeah.
If I remember right, there was 27 people that said yes.
It was mostly Western civilization, as I recall.
And I did not know half of them. I didn't, you know, because some of those were the investment guys that were just putting the money in. Yeah. You know, they weren't the private equity guys, but the money behind the private equity. And so, you know, that was an eye opener, and that was a fun call. Like I said, a fun call to be on. And so don't, you know, when I say don't be in a hurry, just plan it well and know that it's going to be a process and get with the right people to have a plan. And I think those are, and then, you know, ask the right questions to know what the future is going to look like. Yeah. And what you're going to, if you stay on, if you don't stay on, you better have a very, very proven people in place to run the company. And because you're not going to fool anybody if you don't. And so you're not going to get the valuation. And then if you are going to stay on, of course, you're going to get a bigger valuation and you should continue to grow the business, and you take the risk down for the acquirer because they can see what you've done with it, and they're going to give you capital to grow it. So they're going to expect growth, and with capital, you know, is there any reason not to grow the heck out of it? And that's the stage our company's in right now. So we're really accelerating the growth now and have the things in place to double the business in 4 years. So that's where we're headed. Yeah. I didn't, you know, to have over 400 coworkers is that was never really a dream of mine, because I don't know the newer ones' first names that much, you know? So it's only a few that I get to work around that I know, but it's fun. And I, you know, they always say this, but I would say there's going to be a day where you're going to probably sell it. So start planning now and thinking about it. And the more you do that, the more that day will come, and there won't be any really surprises. It'll go much smoother. And, you know, somebody pretty young that still wants to work and grow a business, they might say, I'm not even going to think about it for another 10 or 15 years. Well, I'm not so sure that's the right strategy. I think you should start thinking about it and learning about it at any time. Because for one thing, you might change your mind and you might accelerate that. Instead of working another 15 years, it might be 10 years, and at least working in that business. But planning is a very, very important thing, because you probably will only do this once.
Well, in knowing how wildly successful your business has been twice, and now into the third regime, you're growing it, you know, exponentially. You are a wizard. I mean, to be blunt, because I'm sure, knowing you, that you'd like to say a lot of hard work, a lot of it is luck. If you can get, what is it, the intersection of—
I'm not going to say it's luck. I'm not going to say what luck is. I don't believe in luck. Luck is a residue of hard work. Luck is a residue of hard work. That's the definition.
Preparation and hard work. So to my listeners,
preparation meeting opportunity is another definition of luck. But
thank you. Thank you. I messed that up. You hit the nail on the head. So to my listeners, how do they reach you? Because I got a feeling out of this, you're going to become an advisor to a bunch of businesses. I don't know if you want to take that on, but how would they reach you?
Well, that's actually kind of what I do is advise companies. And that's my sweet spot right now. I really enjoy that. And I'd love to help other people, and I enjoy that part. I mean, that's what I really like doing right now, and I think it's my best spot right now. So, but I just give my email is probably best, which is sburbridge, burbridge, anthony@phonyphce.com. sburbridge@anthonyphce.com. What's Anthony Plumbing, Heating, Cooling, and Electric is what that Anthony PHCE stands for.
So you now know how to run him down to retain him. But we got a master class today, listeners. I mean, this is not anything you've heard from any of my other podcasts. So, Steve, I really appreciate you doing it. Thank you. You've been a gentleman.
I enjoyed it. Thanks.
If you are in search of assistance please go to davidsider.com and schedule a free consultation. Also, I would ask for you to subscribe to the show, rate it for me, and leave me your comment at your favorite podcast platform, such as Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Until next time, be safe, everyone. This podcast is provided for educational purposes. It does not constitute legal advice and is not intended to establish an attorney-client relationship. The recommendations contained in this podcast are not necessarily appropriate for every individual or business. In determining the best course of action, business owners, please consult with an attorney on your individual and distinct circumstances.